Welcome, welcome, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are here with episode number 3, the magic 3 of the Experience Grind podcast. I am your Hobo Jesus host, Kyle, joined with the always gorgeous
Ryan Demarest.
Mr. Ryan Demarest, my gorgeous co-host, makes me look like a slob.
This is really just crazy.
I'm really very
nice, over-flattering introductions.
I'm physically sexually attracted to you, Ryan. That's what I'm trying. That's the whole basis of this podcast.
Oh, it was a ruse.
I just wanted you in the same room with me. Sorry, Laura.
That explains the dildos.
He's my dude now. No, this is the Experience Grind podcast. Just a quick rundown, the basic premise of this podcast. Ryan and I are gigantic dorks. We like all things nerdy. Varying yes. degrees of the nerdiness of that. Primarily a focus on video games and movies. This first first run of episodes we're going to do is breaking down our favorite movies and video games,
which were covered in the previous two episodes.
Yeah, if you didn't listen to those two, the first two episodes cover our favorite movies and video games, so go listen to those. And this episode will be on our number 5 favorite movies.
Which, let's do a little refresher. Kyle, what was your number 5 favorite movie?
My number 5 favorite movie was The Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro. And I butchered that name just a bit.
Just a little bit.
Just a bit.
All right, so say it again, and then we'll just edit it back in.
Guillermo del Toro.
Perfect. That one sounded on point.
I can do it. Not when I'm a little hammered.
Also, let's not go back and edit
no,
that.
No, of course. We're just going to roll with it. Yeah, okay. It's good. So, Ryan, what was your number 5 favorite movie that I watched?
I forgot for a second. My number 5 movie is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, it's good.
Which is Shane Black's written, I guess, his directorial debut with Robert Downer.
He wrote it and directed.
There you go. My turn. Robert Downer Jr. and Val Kilmer are the two big names in there. But that's my number 5. Now, I guess this is going to be a break. How are we going to discuss this? Are we going to go from one movie to the next? Or?
Well, first, I think let's warm up. Like, you know, I like to get everybody, you know, give the audience a little piece of us, a little bit more each episode, just so they can try to understand us more, where we're coming from in this dorkness that we reside in and occupy full time. Just give them a hint. We are in October. Mm-hmm. It is the month of the devil, All Hallows Eve. We've had the request to hear what our favorite scary movie is. And I will define, you know, it doesn't have to be scary. I'm doing air quotes to the audience. It doesn't have to be scary. But just favorite movie in that genre. The horror, all things that occupy that era. So, Ryan, I will ask that to you. Your favorite scary movie, sir?
All right, well, thank you for that introduction again. My favorite scary movie would be Mamma Mia.
That's a all callback, right. Audience, if you didn't listen to our first episodes. That's called callback and humor.
All right, so my actual favorite scary movie or favorite horror movie is Cabin in the Woods, probably, which is not usually how I like to do it. I like to put some more distance usually. I don't like to pick newer things as my favorites because I just...
That's the Joss Whedon flick, right?
It is. It was from 2012.
Did he direct it too, or did he just write it?
He wrote it. Drew Goddard.
Okay, yeah. Drew Goddard directed it.
Who is now, I guess at one point, he's behind the Sinister Six movie that's being in development.
Really?
That may or may not go through because of this new Spider-Man.
Well, I know
Ant-Man
was in
deal.
It was in a limbo there for a long time, and eventually the director had to step away for it to get made. Which is sad, because I would like to see
in production. He was halfway through and then he got ousted.
But
anyway,
that's
changes.
Ant-Man. Ant-Man will probably make a resurgence later on in our 2015 recap movie.
Stay tuned,
listeners.
I'm sure he will.
But yeah, Cabin in the Woods. I'm totally into that. I fucking love that movie.
Yes. It's like a perfect comedy and it's a perfect horror. It does both very well.
It turns everything on its head in a respectful manner.
Yes. It's very
It pays
meta.
Homage. Yes.
It's very
it's
meta.
So meta. Very meta. I agree with that.
But also very affectionate and loving
correct.
Towards the horror genre.
I would agree with that Great. So what would be your favorite part then, I guess, of Cabin in the Woods?
Well, it's probably not any of the meta humor, even though I like that a lot. Yeah. I love the callback for the mermaid, merman.
Yeah.
And I think there are some really funny jokes there. But I think it's the third act reveal is the best part of that whole movie.
Yeah.
It's a build up, and then you finally see the monsters, and it's zombie hillbillies, and I was just like heartbroken. I was like, oh, that's what we're going to get, huh? Just another zombie movie. And I'm like, it's okay. I'm like still enjoying it. And then she finds like the underground lab with all of the monsters from every movie.
It was great.
And just that payoff of seeing every little reference in there. Like there's a Pinhead reference from Hellraiser. There's a Carrie reference. There's all kinds of references in there. And then just the pandemonium that unleashes. It's,
I know too, there were some, really I don't know how deep into the, you know, I'm, you know, as we've said, I'm a big dork. After I watch any movie, I immediately, my favorite thing to do is go to IMDb and read trivia for the movie I've just watched. And I guess at one point there was intended to be a crossover between this movie and the Valve video game series Left 4 Dead. Did you know this?
No.
Yeah, and there are actually cut segments of some of the Left 4 Dead monsters in Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, like, that would have been interesting.
The tank is one of the, like when they have the glass monsters all in, like mm-hmm. the tank is a monster you can see. I know the witch is actually, I think, still in the movie. You can see the witch at one point.
That sounds like it could very well be just a woman crying in a corner.
Exactly,
yeah
but
easy
she's
thing.
Very pale. But yeah, that's totally in there. And I know that there were talks to do a Cabin in the Woods, I think DLC, but it just never panned out. So that's why I think it was also cut from the movie, unfortunately. Because I think that would have been cool, and it could have played off very well for you and I in this podcast.
I thought you were going with Valve and then Half-Life, and you have like a head crab in a cage somewhere.
No, it was totally Left 4 Dead series.
Oh, okay.
So, I think for me, you know, I've seen Cabin in the Woods. I love that film, too. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite part is probably when Chris Hemsworth is going to be super big hero, save the day. He's going to ramp that motorcycle over the canyon.
Yes.
And he goes and just, he hits that invisible wall, and that dude... I did not see that coming.
A literal invisible wall.
Yes. Like, I did not see that coming at all. I thought that was amazing. And then
he's gone.
He's dead. That's it. Boom. No dramatic resurgence. He's not there to save the day.
Well,
I'm also kind of partial to the fact that the pothead does save the day.
Well, kind of.
Yeah, to an extent.
But the interesting thing about Chris Hemsworth, big movie star, was that movie was shot before Thor was ever in production.
Really? So
it was shot and
that.
Finished, but they had nobody who wanted to release the film. So in that meantime, like Joss Whedon was being coached for the Avengers probably long before Thor and Captain America. Joss Whedon was one who's like, I worked with this Chris Hemsworth guy. I think he'd be a good Thor.
Wow.
That movie got Thor the part.
Well, shit, I did not know that. See, mm-hmm. we're doing...
There you go.
We're
trading some knowledge.
We're trading trivias here, bro.
Yeah.
I like that.
I've seen Cabin in the Woods a few times, and it's just, it's good. It hasn't dropped in my
staying on
estimation.
This vein, okay, so you've seen Cabin in the Woods, and this is not my favorite movie, but
no,
I just want to ask, have you seen Tucker and Dale vs. Evil?
I sure have.
What, you like that movie? Because it's very similar in the way that it breaks this genre down.
Yes.
But it does it in a completely different way. And I always like that about it, too. Like, it also turns out, it's you know, for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's, and I meant to do this last episode. We should point out this podcast is very spoiler heavy.
Yeah, I'm not going to be like outright like this happened in this movie.
But we will break down many things of both
just naturally
movies
it's
and games
come
just,
out.
And I will try to remember from now on to give a spoiler warning before things. But because
I
myself hate spoilers. I know I hate when things get ruined. I've had so many things ruined for me, and it bothers me. I've had Game of Thrones ruined for me.
Yeah,
TV
that's
show.
Unfortunate.
I had the Harry Potter book series ruined for me with the whole
by
Snape,
the movies.
Snape kills Dumbledore. No, from the book. I don't know. So I'm very anti-spoilers. So I like to give warning that spoilers are coming.
I think
so
it's very respectful.
Coming back to Tucker Dale versus Evil, the whole premise is that these two redneck hillbillies that live in the woods are not actually trying to hunt these group of college kids that come out. They're trying to help them, but through a series of zany mishaps, all of the college kids end up dying and think that it's due to the redneck hillbillies in the woods. It's done fantastic. It's a nice little, it's all very tongue-in-cheek. It's very good. So.
I think it's very good, and I will defend Cabin in the Woods. That, again, there is that third act just absolutely crazy, and that would be, if there was a tie, that would push it over for
me. Well, I love Cabin in the Woods, how it once Sigourney Weaver shows up and starts breaking that fourth wall and explaining, you know, how the old ones, and we're really the old, like, I love that. It's so...
It's very smart. Like, the characters start to turn into their stereotypes in the woods, and, like, the horror tropes are just all being manipulated to serve the horror tropes, essentially, which are...
Because, you know, a lot of times, and it's true, horror fans, like, true hardcore horror fans, are fucking stupid. Like... For the most part.
And they like the formula.
They don't love the formula. And I hate the formula. I like things that break the formula. Give me something fucking new.
Yes. Yes, always.
So, but that's me. I'm not a horror fan. Most people don't pander to me. But I like it when people do.
Yeah. Break it out, yeah, so. My tastes get pandered to in like Scott Pilgrim, and then the movie makes $10.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is just me paying.
That's why we're dorks.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely not the majority. No. But what is your favorite horror movie?
I'm going to try, it's also in the same vein of Cabin in the Woods.
Interesting.
And it's probably the first horror movie I saw that scared me and also made me laugh. And that would be Army of Darkness.
That's a good choice.
Army of Darkness I saw before I had ever seen Evil Dead 1 or 2. It was my first introduction to the Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell love connection. And it was fantastic, but there were parts that scared the shit out of me, like when he goes into the well and fights the deadites in the well.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that terrified me as, I think I was maybe 11 or 12 years old the first time I saw this movie. Like, I had not been prepared for that. Okay. But, you know, and it just rewatch, I don't know, it's my favorite of the Evil Dead trilogy. It goes back and forth. It's not a lot of people's, I understand. But for me, I think a large part of it is nostalgia, too. Mm-hmm. Again, it was the first one I saw, so it's kind of...
And it's the more overly funny and entertaining of the three,
it's
too.
Definitely, it's...
Which I think it's... this is not to like disparage anybody who likes that, but it is more accessible. Like, it's...
Yeah, absolutely.
It is approachable to way more people than the first two Evil Deads.
I would agree with you there.
Which is a good thing. Like, I love Army of Darkness, and that's why I did it, because I don't know if I could choose between Evil Dead 2 or Army of Darkness.
I watched Army of Darkness before I'd ever played a Duke Nukem game, and half of Duke Nukem's most famous quotes are from Army of Darkness. The other half are from the movie They Live.
Yeah.
From John Carpenter, starring the late, great Roddy Piper.
And Mekhi Phifer.
Yes. But, it's Roddy Piper. That's who I am. But no, he's got the, Hail to the King, baby. That's, I think, one of most Duke Nukem's famous lines. That's Bruce Campbell.
I feel like there's also the kicking ass and chewing gum.
That was in They Live.
Okay, in They Live.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I could not do
this. They get confused. Game. That's what's crazy about all of this, is that everything gets mished and mashed and... It all becomes one.
It was that era of the one-liner manly man.
Oh, man. But Bruce Campbell plays it so well. And I love Bruce Campbell. Mm-hmm. And I have not checked out the Showtime series. Is it have you seen it?
I don't think it's out yet.
I think it comes out
at the end of October.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that would make sense to get it. On this note, what did you think of the remake of The Evil Dead?
It was very different.
Yes.
But I really, really enjoyed it.
I had a blast at that movie.
Yeah, I don't think that's the popular opinion because, of course, again, it's going back to the horror fans. They want what they want. It wasn't this, so I'm disappointed. It wasn't The Evil Dead, but I really enjoyed it.
Well, and I guess that movie was made with the full blessings of both Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. They both read the script and were like, this is amazing. Yes, do it. And again, you know, It's homage, but it turns a lot of things on their head, but still pays respect. It never cheapens the original Evil Dead, which I was worried about that it was going to do, but man, I don't know. I don't really know what else to say about it. And it's really good. And
I thought it was pretty faithful. Like it wasn't that. The tone was definitely a lot darker and more serious.
More serious.
But at the same time, by the time you get to that third act, It is literally raining blood. She has the chainsaw for a hand. She makes like the Deadite eat the chainsaw. Yeah. And it's just like, this is definitely Evil Dead 2 Army of Darkness style. When, and like, you got there. You got there. So it's fine.
I felt weird because I saw that movie in theaters. And like, when it starts raining blood, mm-hmm. I was laughing maniacally. And I felt bad because there was nobody else in this theater laughing. And I just, it was like, that's the fucking most metal thing I've ever seen. It is literally raining blood right now. It I is was pretty nobody awesome. Into this. This is amazing.
Yes.
I love that part. That
I don't even think I had many issues at all with the movie, but if I did, that third act redeemed it. It was like, okay, worth anything we got here to this point.
When it, you know, they get the chainsaw in there, mm-hmm. chick loses her hand. I mean, it hits all these notes mm-hmm. that the Evil Dead and I don't see how people could be upset with it. Other than the fact that it doesn't star Bruce Campbell.
And it's, I think, too graphic and focuses on the torture porn, quote unquote.
I didn't even find it torture porny. Like, as a guy that doesn't like the Saw series so much.
Interesting. Like, okay.
I don't like Saw. I don't really like, Donnie Berkowitz, the Bear Jew. What is his fucking name?
Oh, Eli Roth.
Eli Roth. I did not like either of the hostiles.
You know him as the Bear Jew, but not Eli. Okay.
Come on, we're Tarantino guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I did not like
originally supposed
of the hostiles.
To be Adam Sandler.
Yeah, which I would have liked
I would
to
have
seen.
Liked that. Yeah, me too.
I totally would. And apparently Django was originally offered to Will Smith.
Who turned
also
it down?
Would have liked to have seen.
Will Smith is like famous for turning down these roles because he was originally supposed to be the Neo in The Matrix as well.
Yeah, which and I would not have liked to have seen.
Nick Cage also offered Neo and turned
it
down.
I'm so glad Keanu got that role. Yes. A lot of people hate on Keanu. He does, like, dude, okay, Keanu and Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes. Oh, bad. It's great.
No, he's bad in that, though. Like, Gary Oldman and Anthony Hopkins are fucking great.
I don't know why I said great, because I've never seen that movie.
Really? You've never seen Bram Stoker's Dracula?
No. Nope.
Oh, man. That's.
I got excited, so I was like, yeah, it's great. But I've never seen that movie.
That's one we will have to work in, because, I mean, for real, though, Keanu is terrible in that movie. He was severely miscast. And even, I think it's Francis Ford Coppola directed that.
Yeah.
Even he's like, I love Keanu. And his problem is he tries very hard to capture an English accent in that movie and just does not at all.
This was much earlier on in his career, too.
Yeah, it was right after Bill and Ted, and he was trying to break away from the Bill and Ted mystique, which I give him credit for. You got to do
he
that.
He still has not.
to an extent.
Though John Wick was pretty amazing.
I would think now he's more known for Neo than Bill and Ted.
Sure. Sure.
Because, again, you know, those movies were fucking monumentous. But, I'm glad he was that over Will Smith. But I would have liked to have seen Will Smith over Jamie Foxx in Django, bringing this all back to where we are.
I agree.
I think
it
Will
would
Smith
have been
has way more
choice.
Chops than Jamie. Jamie plays angry very well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really about all the depth that character has, is angry revenge. He doesn't have the nuance I feel Will Smith could have brought to that.
Yeah. I don't really know if I know Will Smith for nuance.
No, but that's the thing. He's not, but he's good. And I think
I like Will Smith. Yeah. But I don't. Nuance isn't what I equate to him.
Exactly. But I think he could have brought more nuance than Jamie Foxx. Although,
yeah, I'll give you that.
Jamie Foxx was fantastic in Collateral.
Him and Tom Cruise both. Yeah. That's a great Michael Mann. I think it's a Michael Mann
it's
movie.
Michael Mann. It's
yeah.
Michael Mann.
It's a great one that people overlook. That's a good one.
So let's get into this list, bro.
All right.
We should have really established this before the podcast started, but who should go first?
Oh, man.
Do you want to go or do you want me to go?
Hartman.
Let's have the sound engineer, Mr. Andrew Hartman, pick. Oh, he's picked me.
Yes. All right. Good.
So I will pop this episode 3 cherry of our number 5 movie list.
Yes.
So bringing it back again, let's bring everybody in. The number 5 movie I'm going to be talking about is Mr. Ryan Demarest, and he has selected the movie Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. You want to give me a little more background? Who's directed this again?
All right. So I think I've mentioned this now a few times, but just again, it's Shane Black, who I have the biggest crush on professionally. He is just, I love everything he does. He wrote Lethal Weapon. He wrote The Last Boy Scout. I had to careful there. There are many the last Airbender, something. Yeah,
not The Last Airbender. The Last Boy Scout. Which was that Adam Sandler?
Last Boy Scout.
No, that's
Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans.
That's right. That's right. See, I'm thinking of Damon Wayans and Adam Sandler movie.
The movie opens up with like a football player.
Yes, exactly.
He makes play and then he shoots
himself in the head in the middle of the field. Yeah. I watched that movie with my dad.
Which is a great movie.
Yeah.
It is dated now.
A little bit.
All Get Out. Yeah. Some of the 90s darkness.
Yeah.
Just doesn't quite fit. But anyway, Shane Black wrote that and then he kind of disappeared from Hollywood for many a year, just like Robert Downey Jr., the star of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But he came back, wrote and directed this movie, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is a buddy cop noir detective crime thriller that eschews not only the noir and like detective films, but also Hollywood itself.
Okay, so I'm going to jump in now and, take over because I have seen this movie, but it was a long time ago that I saw it. One thing that I don't think you and I have ever come together on and that you don't know about me, and this is another thing for you and I to know, I love the film noir genre.
Yes.
I love it. One of my favorite movies that is not in my list, but I enjoyed this movie is The Maltese Falcon.
Interesting.
Oh,
okay.
My God. Like, anything film noir is instantly going to hook me. And I think a part of that, you know, I see a little bit of that in Drive, which will come up a bit later. But again, as soon as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang started, here's my first note. Film noir, !! Heart.
He drew a little heart.
I did draw a little heart. Because as soon as Rob, like, they had that low jazz and Robert Downey Jr. was narrating and I was like, oh my God, this is a film noir. I fucking know it. And I was like, oh, I'm so into this already.
Yeah.
So I love film noir. So thank you so much for that.
Which is also, real quick, I'm going to interject too. Again, Shane Black also did Iron Man 3, he wrote and directed, which is why it stars Robert Downey Jr. doing the narration, film noir. He brought it back around. So
it all goes through. Everything is circles, especially with things that you and I are going to talk about. Everything in life. I'll break this in just real quick. Ka is a wheel, my friend. Ka is a wheel. My Dark Tower friends will know and pick up on that. Nobody else will, and they'll think I'm crazy. But it basically means life is a circle. What goes around is going to come around. So back into this. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
Film noir. I fucking love it, man. I love it.
I do,
It has such an atmosphere. It has been done since the fucking 30s. Countless times, sometimes bad, sometimes good. The thing that you had said about this is that what I love is that it is film noir, but it also brings in that lethal cop or lethal weapon buddy cop vibe to it with Perry and Harry. I'm just going to read some of my notes here. I've got RDJ is Harry. He is the textbook unreliable narrator. And what I love about that
the
is also...
Fourth wall breaks are so good with the unreliable narrator stuff.
Oh, man, and he does it so well.
Yeah.
And God, I'm so glad. This was, you know, I think I said this in the movie breakdown of our list, but this was the return of Robert Downey Jr.
Yes.
From his scandals.
Mm-hmm. It was. It was his first movie back. The movie that got him Iron Man.
God, it's so good to have RDJ back. I love
it
this
really
man.
It really is.
I didn't realize it until just recently, but he is one of my favorite actors. I would honestly agree. What he does so well. And that's that smug, sarcastic asshole that you shouldn't like, but really you love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
well, he does it in a way that he plays like the smug asshole. He's arrogant. He's all this, but nuance is there and you can always tell there's vulnerability to all of his characters.
Yeah.
And it's his Harry is pretty much like Tony Stark. Like it's the same character pretty much.
To a degree. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Like maybe a little bit more masculine and hero in Tony Stark because
Harry is not a heroic character
who's forced into these weird situations that require more of him than he has.
There's a lot of that in the movie. And I, it's not a perfect movie. And I don't, here's one thing.
Disagree.
I know you will, and that, but that's why it's you in your top five. I don't think it would still break my top five as after watching it.
Sure.
I do think it's very high, and I enjoyed every second of it, and I would watch it again easily.
Yeah.
And I think, what you know, there are parts it does kind of drag a bit, and that, you know, again, this is just me.
Disagree.
Exactly. That's why. But it is, it's a fun movie. It's yes. fantastic. I tell you what, I'm going to go back now and watch more movies, also with Michelle Mohagan. Holy cow.
Michelle Mohagan. Yeah.
She's great in this. She is sexy. She's flirty. She's fun.
She is crush-worthy in this movie for
very,
sure.
Very easily. And
Sadly, she has not done much since. Mission Impossible 3 was her big thing. And then if you've seen Mission Impossible 4, they kind of just completely get rid of her character.
And that's so sad.
And then that's it. She's been doing a bunch of kind of romantic comedies and
she's really good at this. She holds her own with Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr., which yes. is hard to do, I would imagine. And man, she does it.
She does it very
like,
well.
Like every time she was on the screen, I was pulled in.
I think her name's Harmony in the movie.
Yes, and that's another
thing.
Which
speaks to...
I think that might be a play on Harmony Cornine, who is he's a pulp novel writer.
Ooh.
So I think
probably
I
is.
Think that's, I think I'm almost, I didn't
See,
research
I just
that.
Went with Harmony because she brings anything but harmony. She's dissonant. She is dissonant.
I thought it as she's.
That's yeah, clever. Okay.
Pulp novel. He's a very good pulp novel writer too.
Also, if you're liking these deeper thoughts and deluges into metaphors, then you're going to really like our Pan's Labyrinth conversation.
Oh, good. Right. I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, Harmony Cornine, and I think I'm pretty sure he wrote. Have you ever watched Justified?
I haven't, but I really want to.
Yeah, it's got a very noir vibe, and I'm pretty sure he's one of the main writers. And I'm gonna, you know, people that listen to this, if I'm wrong, are gonna rip us a new one. And please do. That's what we're here for. If we're wrong, let us know.
Only Kyle rip Kyle a new one.
So one of the jokes I like, it was just a throwaway joke, but I did write this down too. When they're in the bar. And they're talking, it's when RDJ and
is
Harmony,
it
Harry
shaking
and Harmony.
The country?
No.
Okay.
But when they meet up, I guess there's, at the beginning of the movie, it shows that they knew each other, but you don't know that. Mm-hmm. And then he finally meets her at this bar and he's talking to her. And she finally lets loose that they know each other. And she says, she references somebody else in the bar as... I can't even remember, and I'm not going to try to justify
it. I think, is it Indian Joe Pesci?
That's what I wrote down, is Native American Joe Pesci. And then they cut to this guy, and oh my God, it's a Native American Joe Pesci. That's exactly who that looks like.
Yep.
I love those two. There's one before that I didn't write down. It wasn't as funny.
No.
But man, when they cut to that.
Well, that's, you brought it up. What do I think of Native American Joe Pesci?
Yeah.
There's a reason. That one's the better joke. But.
Oh man. And it works so well. And that got an audible laugh out of me. Mm-hmm. Another thing I wrote down here is that, and this is totally true, and you know, I had this problem probably when I was younger. I was influenced by movies, and you will find this out when we watch Drive. I have a very special treat for Drive.
Interesting.
But,
you know, wear the leather scorpion jacket.
Robert Downey Jr. makes smoking look so damn cool in this movie.
Well, that's the noir thing, right?
Exactly.
That's what you have to.
Exactly, but there's so many little... flourishes he does with the cigarettes and the lighting them and just all these things. And God, I wanted to smoke cigarettes after watching this movie, man. I just wanted to be like, God, life sucks. I want to fucking drink whiskey and smoke cigarettes and contemplate my life in an inner monologue and just hash it all out. It was great, man. He makes it look so cool and just so effortless.
Yeah.
And I think that's a testament to RDJ. There's a lot of Robert Downey Jr. love in this.
Oh, for sure. I think that's something I did not notice. So that's good that you brought it to it, because I would have never picked up like,
you know,
oh man,
yeah. Maybe
he
when
is
you
smoking
watch it again,
like a badass.
Maybe
I probably
when you
will
watch
now.
It again, yeah, check that out, because it's totally there. There's especially one part where I think after he gets his ass beat at the party, and he does this little, he like flips it around, puts it in, and then brings the lighter up, and just it's all so cool. So, and I just want to be like, God, I wish I looked that cool smoking cigarettes.
That's a cool thing, though, in movies when they have, like, these small little character details that you don't have to notice, but if you do, it's another little nugget to enjoy.
And, this movie also made me really want another Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer movie.
Which is Val Kilmer in general funny again, because he does it so well.
They work off each other so greatly. Like, I really, like, Gay Perry, he puts up a very hard outer shell.
Yes.
But Val Kilmer plays it in the way that, you know, there is a warmth underneath that, and he really lets that come through in certain moments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he tries to play it off that he doesn't like Harry, but he does. Like, he's got concern for the dude. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's, I want to see them in more things together. I think they do really well. They have great chemistry on
the screen. It was sad that this movie never got the crowd that it deserved. So yeah. There's no Kiss Kiss Bang Bang 2, because this could have easily been franchise.
You know, I like when Val Kilmer, he's talking to Robert Downey Jr. and something terrible has just happened. I think it's when he throws he throws his gun. He like wipes it and throws it
in the lake.
And he's like, you know what you would see if you looked up the definition of the word idiot in the dictionary? And Harry goes, a picture of me? And he goes, no, the definition of idiot, which you fucking are. Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah, there are so many just solid lines like that in the movie that just play on your expectations. Like, I love the scene where Harry finds a corpse and he acts. So, all right, he's going to the bathroom and he looks over to the right and just under the sink is a corpse. And he turns and he starts peeing it while on the phone.
Right here, I have the note. Piss on the body. That's so, like, I've never seen that.
No.
He just turns around and he pisses on this dead body because he's totally caught off guard while he's taking a piss.
Yes, and then has the phone call with Gay Perry about it, in which case they talk about it. And it's so good because he tries to blow past it like, I think I peed on the corpse. Can they find that in the DNA? And Gay Perry's like, stop. I get to ask questions now. Yeah. Why in blue perfect hell would you pee on a corpse?
It just happened.
Yeah, it's... this is the Chris Farley show. I'm just going to do scenes and be like, this scene was really great.
It's okay. We can do the Chris Farley show.
The number counting at the end where the guy pulls the gun on him and Harry takes the gun back, has Russian roulette, and he brings up the odds and statistics.
Yeah.
And it's just so good. So, like, you know,
they're setting you up this whole thing.
The trope is you put the gun to somebody's head with one bullet in it and you click it once or twice or three times.
You increase this sense of dread. Like, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And then the guy talks. So Harry takes the gun, flips it, shoots, fires first shot. Guy's dead. They have no lead now. And so Robert Downey Jr. is just like, well, I mean, statistically, I had an 8% chance. He was fine. 8%? How do you do your math? Like, there are six bullets in there. And then it just turns into...
I love that Perry's like, you put a fucking live round in that? What were you trying to bluff him with? You put a live round in the gun.
Yes, yeah, so...
Before that scene, I also had written... Perry just goes, I'm going to break your nose now. And then he fucking smacks the guy with the gun and breaks his nose. Mm-hmm. I love... There's that deliberateness with the Gay Perry character. Like...
Yes.
He's
hard boiled, direct.
I guess to bring this back to the noir, he's the hard boiled detective. I mean, he plays the private investigator. You know, the whole movie there's all kinds of twists and turns. You know, mm-hmm. you never know what's going on. It's very well done. I really enjoyed this movie. You know,
again,
my one complaint would be I think the pacing is just a bit off. I think maybe it drags a bit in between the second and third acts, maybe into that a bit.
Sure.
Like when they're getting into the mental hospital and stuff. But there was reason for it to be there. It doesn't flow so well at that moment in time.
I agree. I think I agree completely. I still think the movie works perfectly for me. So
yeah.
I understand that. But I will say there is about 20 minutes in the middle where you get the fake girl, the sister stuff, it becomes a little bit weighted down in like these double crosses. Well, you thought it was this, but it's not that, and it's not this. Oh, it's this. So you have like four or five different versions of what's happening that just keep getting overturned in these 20, 30 minute stretch.
They're trying to set up the red herrings,
yes.
Which I understand, and you're going to have. But yeah, again, it just, it drags. And,
yes.
You know, it doesn't detract from the movie as a whole. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my number one test, I did watch this with Mandy, my girlfriend. And, you know, anytime I try to broach anything with Mandy, especially movie wise, she's like, because I've had some misses with Mandy. I've had a lot of hits, but with anything, she never remembers the hits. She remembers the misses. And she's like, what is this? What are you trying to make me watch? And after we watched it, she's like, wow, I really like that movie. You were right. That was really good. So that passes the Mandy test. She did enjoy it very well. So
I'm writing down a question for next time, which is Mandy test. What are some of these misses I'm curious about?
Well, I'll go ahead and tell you one right now is the movie Antichrist.
Why would you watch that with her?
Because I'd never seen it.
You're a bad boyfriend.
And I'd heard on Reddit that it was a really good scary movie. Scary movies. No, it is not. It's a fucking crazy movie.
It's not a scary movie. It's like David Lynch, gonzo, batshit.
Dude, that's,
like,
David Lynch has nothing on that movie. That's
labia's getting cut. That's not
maybe
labia.
Maybe
I'm
crazy.
Off.
Maybe that's Harmony Korine. Maybe he's the one who directed that. Huh? I think I'm putting that in now. Because I know that name, and I know
there's a Harmony Korine.
That's it.
Who does Spring Breakers and Trash Humpers, which is just this.
I think he did Antichrist, too.
He did not. That is, I know for sure, it's Lars von Trier.
That's right. But yeah. Here's where I'm
getting in. Crazy German and his
Lars von Trier and Harmony Korine are both part of that film 95 weird group where they don't use CGI. Mm-hmm. And like everything is as real as possible when they shoot the movie.
Okay.
But yeah, I know that's where that's coming from. Okay.
Yes.
So we just fixed ourselves. Fuck you, internet. You don't have to correct us.
That's not it. Okay.
Cut out the hate mail.
All right. So.
But yeah. Spring Breakers. What are we saying? Who knows? Who cares?
The Mandy test. Antichrist. Yeah, the Mandy test. You made her watch Antichrist.
In my defense, I had never seen Antichrist.
I've never seen Antichrist either.
Have you made Laura watch it? Has Laura?
Oh, because we watch horrible shit all together. Okay. Because she's cool with my horrible choices.
We watched it together. We love shit like that.
But the opening scene is like a black and white shot of them fucking while their kid jumps out of a window and dies in slow motion.
Yeah.
Which is beautifully shot.
The movie is gorgeous, but it's so fucking odd, man.
Yeah, I did not.
Willem Dafoe hangs
like
dong.
Antichrist.
That dude's got
a
big dong. But yeah, Antichrist is weird. I did not like it at all.
I don't. The fox says something to him at one point.
He says, "Chaos reigns." I remember that very vividly.
That was
chaos reigns.
That point, like when something like that happens, I'm just like, I'm out now. I'm out. You've taken me out of your movie.
There's
this
also
is...
the fawn that's having a stillbirth.
Well, that I understand. That's horrifying, and that could happen. Looking at you and saying chaos reigns. I think that's like right before the act break. Because if I remember.
Yeah, it is right before an act break. Yeah. It's so fucking weird. I'm so glad we're on this page that you don't like that movie either.
Let's just talk about Antichrist for the next 30 minutes.
It's bad.
You came to hear about Kiss really Kiss Bang Bang. We're going to talk about Lars von Trier.
It's bad. You should watch it, but be prepared. It is a fucking trip.
Yeah, it's
I will just throw this one phrase out there. At one point, there is blood ejaculated from a penis.
Oh, that's right. I always remember the female mutilation stuff.
There is that too. She cuts
that's
her total pussy lips off. Oh my god, she cuts her pussy lips off.
This is what I said, and Laura said that did not happen. It was the clitoris.
I think it was pussy lips, but it could have been clitoris.
I swore it was the lips.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah. I didn't know.
I thought it was lips. Holy shit. Episode 3. We're talking about ejaculating blood and pussy lips. This is not us, by the way.
We're making this up.
This is the movie Antichrist. We're not making this up. This happens in this movie that is not an X-rated porno. It is a movie.
It's not an X-rated porno.
Holy fuck. Watch Antichrist and talk to us about it because it is so fucked.
Yes.
It is it's one of the most fucked movies I've ever seen.
It is on Netflix, I'm pretty sure.
Now? I remember renting it. God damn.
I feel like that's how I watched it, but it's...
That movie fucked me, man. Like, bad. Like, I was like... Like, I remember watching it, and like, it was... Like, I let the credits play for a bit, and I just looked at the screen like, what?
Yeah.
Just happened.
Yeah.
Like, and there's no real resolution to anything. It's just... I mean, you kind of figure out that the wife is fucking insane.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, I'm not prepared to talk about Antichrist tonight. I don't remember a lot of it because I don't know about
you,
but it was
bro.
Like 4 or 5 years ago I saw it. Maybe not. Maybe it's not even been that long since it's been released.
I think it's maybe been two for me.
I feel like I was in Korea when I watched it.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I just remember sitting at the end and being like, I don't know if I should invest time into like deciphering the metaphors and what everything means. I'm like, I'm okay with not knowing what this guy wants to say. Like, that film was so hateful.
Yeah.
And just
so
mean-spirited. And I was like, nope, I don't need to learn anything about this.
Let's break this fucking mold. Let's get out of this slump. Talk to me about Pan's Labyrinth.
Yay. All right.
Because this is a fucking great director who knows
Guillermo del Toro.
Real Yunus, Guillermo del Toro. Now I can say it and it's fun.
It is.
Yeah.
It is a lot of fun. All right. So, yeah. Do you want to give a little introduction since I gave the intro to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Okay. So, Pan's Labyrinth is a fairy tale movie directed by the great Guillermo del Toro. Who is a Spanish director who's done a lot of fantastic stuff. I love this guy.
Kronos, The Devil's Backbone, God. Mimic, Blade 2, Pan's Labyrinth.
I think Mimic is probably the weakest Hellboy film he's ever done. And Pacific Rim.
I agree. Pacific Rim is there. Yeah, he did that. Yeah. I do not think Pacific Rim is weak. I don't think so.
I'm saying Mimic is his weakest film, but Mimic is still,
I agree.
It's enjoyable.
Yes.
But yeah, so it's a fairy tale about a little girl in Spain, and I think
Ophelia.
1944
specifically.
1944, during a civil war.
It's like I just watched this today.
Yeah, right. and it's her mother has remarried this captain in the military during this revolution.
Which I actually don't think I have his name. I don't know if they ever say it.
I don't know it.
They just refer to him as the Capitan. Yeah, El Capitan.
El Capitan. The whole movie is also in Spanish.
Yes.
Forewarned for people who watch it. It is subtitled, which I don't have a problem with. I'm amazed at the amount of people who do.
I saw this movie in theaters and fell in love with it.
Yeah,
and this was when I was working at the video store, and I would have so many people come back and return it, and they were like, I don't want to watch this. I was like, you just shut up and read and do it, because it's going to be so good. No.
Like, and I, you know, just as a teaser for when we get into
the
games.
We had to warn every single person.
When we get into The Walking Dead, I'm glad I'm a very competent reader, because there are fucking sections where, holy shit, you have three choices to make. Make it really quick.
Fast decisions, yeah.
I would be upset if I could not read at an above level of, I don't even know what I can read really fast, though. And, you know, I could see really dumb people having a problem with subtitled movies. But I remember there was a lot of controversy.
It's a controversial statement.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out.
Oh, that was the first one, wasn't it?
That was one of the first big subtitled movies. I remember a lot of people that I knew that saw it said it sucked because you had to read through the whole movie. And then I finally saw it and I was like, what are you people talking about? Are you retarded? Can you not read?
I think that might have been my first foreign film. Like,
proper, I think it was mine too,
subtitles.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Probably. It was probably a lot of people's first, but it was good.
Yeah.
But, so Pan's Labyrinth. Yeah, it's that. It's so basically Spain, 1944, civil war. A little girl has fairy tales to deal with the trauma that she's experiencing in the real world.
Specifically, and I'll speak to this because not only did I watch the movie today, but then I went and watched it again with director's commentary.
Nice.
While playing a game in the background.
Okay.
So this is like I just listened to Guillermo del Toro tell me his little wisdom nuggets.
Awesome. So, I don't think I've ever done that, so yeah. I'm curious to hear all this.
So it's 1944, which is set a few years after the war in Spain, so like it's already done.
Okay.
There are winners, there are losers, and now it's just getting rid of the leftover renegades and rebels.
Okay.
And so that's what it is, and that is because when Pan's Labyrinth was in development, it was like, I think, 99 or so. It was early on in his career, and then 9/11 happened. And then Guillermo del Toro said when he was filming this, he wanted to kind of make a parallel between, you know, 4 years after what happened in this Spanish war and then like 4 years after what happened 9/11. Like, how are we dealing with this? Like, what is the fallout? And while I don't see that myself, I don't really see much in the way of 9/11 stuff. This is what Guillermo del Toro apparently intended.
Okay.
I don't see it.
Yeah, I don't see it either. Like, I don't pick up on any post 9/11.
None.
But okay.
And hearing that, like, I try to keep an eye out and look for it, but no.
Okay. Interesting.
I don't see that. But yeah, I guess I'll talk about Pan's Labyrinth now.
Yeah, please do.
But
and I'll interject
so
sporadically.
I guess we're gonna talk about the experience. I had seen Pan's Labyrinth several times by this point.
Really?
Okay. It would not make my top five.
It would not. Okay.
It probably still won't, but it is definitely in the top 10.
Good.
For sure.
Okay.
It's always been up there. I think it is Guillermo del Toro's best. I have a soft spot for Blade 2 specifically.
I think this is his best movie. As much as I love both
Hellboys.
I think
this is his best movie. It might not be your favorite. This is his best movie.
I agree.
Guillermo del Toro, I think when it comes to, like, especially his English language films, really flounders with dialogue sometimes, and that's very obvious in the Hellboys and Pacific Rims. Like
Pacific Rim especially. Hellboy,
people don't talk like how people talk in his movies. Yeah. Like, he just does not have a very fluid English language between the characters. So I think his best movies are his native
Kronos.
Yeah, like Kronos. Well, I don't know if Kronos was that?
Yeah, it's Spanish.
That was Spanish. Okay. Mm-hmm. Kronos, Devil's Backbone, and Pan's Labyrinth, I think, are probably his best movies because he's able to work within what he knows. And he does it very well. But aside from just, like, that alone, like, his Pan's Labyrinth is just visually amazing.
God damn, is it not, dude?
It is.
Holy shit.
It is. And then thematically, it's just so clever, too. And I picked up on a lot of things this time because I was really trying to look for it. And I think it's a movie that you can enjoy just by the visuals and just, like, being entertained.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a lot of stuff to dig into, too. Like, whereas Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I think, is a very entertaining, perfect film, there's not a lot of depth there. You're not going to find a lot of symbolism and metaphors and themes. It's largely just like, gosh darn, Hollywood sucks, right? Pan's Labyrinth has so much depth, and it's all about choice and disobedience, and I can get more into that as we go, but yeah, do you have any responses to that? Because I feel like I've just been doing a lot of talking.
I agree with everything. Like, I mean, it's it takes the fairy tale and brings it into the real world in a real way. It does. It's Guillermo del Toro ramped up to 11. Like, he is so on point in this movie. I can't believe it got made, because I feel like this is everything he's ever wanted to do, and he got licensed to do it.
Yeah.
And the studio was just like, yeah, do it, bro. There's so much weird shit in this movie.
I feel like from this movie on, it's just been Guillermo doing whatever Guillermo wants to do.
Yeah.
I think maybe before this with, like, Blade and Mimic, he was in the studio cycle. But, like, from this movie, it's, like, markedly, like, look at Hellboy 2 to Hellboy 1, like, that is Guillermo del Toro unleashed. Like, he's doing all these fable fairy monsters, and he gets to make his jokes about, like, Abe Sapien and Ron Perlman just yucking it up, like, by themselves. Like, that is a Guillermo del Toro movie more so than Hellboy 1. But from here on, it's just, like, that Pacific Rim. Crimson Peak looks like it's, like, Guillermo doing Guillermo.
But see, I think, and even, you know, in a lot of them, like, the Hellboys and Pacific Rim, like, they still shoehorn in that weird Hollywood love story angle that Pan's Labyrinth doesn't have. Pan's Labyrinth is a very real movie.
There is, I guess between Mercedes and Pedro, Mercedes is the maid. Like, that's the only really love story. But
they don't,
like,
really clue in on that. Like, you don't get exposed to it. And it also, spoilers, turns out pretty fucking horribly.
For everybody involved.
Like most things in real life. Like,
yes, which...
That's what I love about this movie, is it really captures life. Like, and that's one of my favorite things about, you know, I'll break it a bit here, No Country for Old Men. Like, nothing goes well in that movie. At no point.
No. Yeah, the heroes don't win.
And not, even when the hero dies, it's off screen. Like, you don't even fucking know about it. Like, it's just, he's dead. Deal with it. We're going on. I love that. I love a movie where the good guy doesn't win, per se. Like, especially, and I think Pan's Labyrinth is fantastic in that sense. Like,
Yeah. I don't. I agree. I like when heroes don't win. I don't know if Pan's Labyrinth is that movie because heroes don't win, but the villains don't win. Nobody wins. It's just a fable. It's
Yeah.
just.
Yeah.
It's. It's. I don't know what it is. It's just. Reality is horrible. And these dark, grim fairy tales would be like a dream compared to like reality because the most violent, horrifying stuff you see is not with the monsters, it's not the creatures, it's
No.
not the trips Ophelia takes. It's this Capitan she's living with who tortures a stuttering man. And just, oh God, that scene is not even like the most violent, but it's just like
Dude.
you say count to three and you can go, you're free. And just that kind of like psychological torture. Then he's like, this one I'm gonna use to find out this and this. This tool I'm gonna use on you to find out this and this. And this last tool, that's when I know I can trust you. I can trust what you're saying. And just like that, obviously there's the iconic imagery of like the monster with the eyes in his hands. With the Pale Man, I think
Yeah,
he's
that's what they
called.
call him.
Yeah.
Who's
And the
also played by
fairies, Doug Jones.
Jug Jones,
Doug
who's.
Jones did him in Pan
Yeah,
in the
which,
movie.
here, I want to get back to Pan,
Yes, let's do
but.
that. But.
You're talking about the brutalness, dude. When the Capitan bashes that dude's face in with that wine bottle.
Which was a true story. Guillermo del Toro was in a fight. His friend got hit with the bottle. He got hit with the chains. And the bottle didn't break like it did in Hollywood. So Guillermo del Toro was like, I need to put a scene like this in my movie.
Dude, like when I saw this movie in theaters because like I love weird shit and I saw this trailer and I was like, I gotta see this movie. And when I dude, I remember like my mouth falling like, what the fuck? Like
This is very early on. This is I want to say the first 15 minutes of the movie
dude,
that this happens.
it's brutal as all hell, man. And it really sets the tone for the man, the type of man that the Capitan is.
Yeah.
Like
It does.
no holds barred. That dude is a fucking brutal dude.
All right. This is my one negative point
Okay,
of the
okay.
movie. Again, like I think it's fantastic to be in my top 10 for sure. But I think, and this is my issue, my only issue, the Capitan, El Capitan, is such a mustache twirling villain. He is just irredeemably bad. Like there's no humanity to him. Like from the get go, we are given like I think some dialogue very quickly that shows he doesn't care for the wife, he just cares for the son,
Exactly.
which is
That's.
laid out several times. He's just a super dick. Like Ophelia reaches to shake his hand as they meet, and he grabs her hand and squeezes it, and he says, "Wrong hand." And it's just there's no warmth, no nuance. This is kind of a one-dimensional character. And hearing the commentary track, Guillermo del Toro was saying like, "Oh, I love to hate him. He is such a villain. I love to hate him." And it's like, I get that, and I think that bias is making him like a character. Like he is not like there's no depth to him, which is fine. You don't always need it, but it is very noticing in a movie where like the mother has like maybe four lines of dialogue, not many at all.
No.
And I fucking felt her death when she died because she does like little things like,
Spoilers.
so she dies. Everybody, spoiler, almost everybody in this
Everybody
movie
fucking
fucking dies.
dies.
But she's given Ophelia a dress and she was like, this is to make you look beautiful and presentable for the dinner party tonight. Like you'll be my little princess, which is a parallel because in the fantasy
Fairy
world, she could
tales.
be
Yeah,
a
yeah.
princess. But the mother just like looks down very sadly at this dress, like very wistfully. And she was like, I would have loved one of these dresses as a kid. I wish I had this. And you can kind of see like just from one fucking line of dialogue, like her whole history is laid bare. You see the type of woman she is that she would wind up with the captain for the money and the security during this time. And like, that's so smart. And I wish that nuance was given to this guy. And he has a little bit with the clock from his father,
Yeah.
but it does nothing because he doesn't really hint on that ever again.
See,
So.
and you got to disagree about Kiss Kiss
Yes,
Bang Bang.
please disagree.
I will disagree because I think that that does show up in when, the son is born And when the maid character, you know, he pleads with her. He's like, just let my son know that I'm a man. And she says, your son will not even know that you existed.
He will never know your name.
Yes. And like, you can see the fucking crush that does to that dude. Like, it breaks that guy. Like,
yeah,
I get what you're saying. And the fact, like, he is incredibly evil and it is very mustache twirly, but
they try to
in the fact that, like, he cares about this. That's the one thing he has in this world, is that son. And then when that is finally taken from him, like, I mean, that's the brutal harshness of this movie, where nothing is good in this movie. Like, it is brutal, brutal, harsh reality.
Well, and that's
in a fantasy setting, which is insane.
Well, that's part of the film's credit. And this is, I love the cinematography, and like, I'm going to put a pin in like the makeup and the effects, because that's something we can talk about too. But just the visual cleverness, like, the movie is set into two different times. You have reality, and then you have Ophelia's fantasies, which may or may not be happening.
We don't know.
You can. It's ambiguous. It's for you to decide.
I like to think they are.
I like to think they are too, because there are several times when things from the fantasy cross over. Yes. And
including,
there's the knife, the key, crosses over.
I'm
and then
just fucking Pan.
Nobody ever sees Pan except for her, though.
Except for her, but he shows up in the real world.
Yeah, but you don't know if it's her imagination or not. True, just like her drawing the chalk and opening the door. Like, it could all be in her head. They want you to come up with that.
Yeah.
But the way they film these two worlds, the reality is very blue. All blues, very saturated, very cold, very dark. The shots are like still shots that are kind of always slowly moving, so you're never like relaxed. You're always a little bit tense. And like, I notice these very subtle camera moves. And then when you go into these fantasy worlds, you get these nice camera shots where, like, there's obviously a crane involved and the camera goes up above people's heads.
And they're very, very warm.
It's very fantastical. Yeah. And the color hue is like very red, very
and
warm
yellow
colors.
And, yeah. I noticed a lot of yellows.
Yeah. So you get this nice kind of loving, warm environment in these fantasies, which she has to escape because the real world is so miserable.
It's fucking bleak.
It is. So it is.
Let's bring... Talk to me about Pan. What are your thoughts on the Pan character?
The character itself, or like
just
everything about it?
Like everything about it. I want to hear about Pan, because I mean, it is Pan's Labyrinth.
All right, so I didn't notice this. This is taken from the commentary track. I did not notice this. But when Pan first meets, he's older than he is later. Every time you meet him, he's much younger.
I have never noticed this either.
Pay attention, because now I see it. His hair is very white and gets gradually more gold and reddish.
Really?
As time goes on. And then at the very beginning, he has like very white, chalky, like cataract eyes.
Yeah, which are creepy as fuck.
Disappear. And by the end shot, he has like kind of normalish eyes again. So I didn't know this, but he's using Ophelia to grow younger as the movie goes on. I did not notice this.
Because Pan, like we've mentioned earlier in the list, by the way, go back and listen to the fucking list episodes, people, please.
Hopefully you're chronologically
listening. We talked about Pan and Loki from... They're very similar. They're tricksters. Yes. They don't have our best interest in heart. They care about themselves first and foremost.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. All right, so his character, I think, is perfectly fine.
Man.
I'm not just like falling over myself in love with this character. I think he is perfectly fine. I have no negative things to say. But like the character design, the way he moves, I think Doug Jones is brilliant. And whoever like the costume effect people are,
was so good.
I think this movie's probably 11, 12 years old now.
And it's you
and
can't
it
tell.
It still looks because the makeup is so good. The effects are so good. It's when you see the fairies or.
Yeah.
The toad underground.
A little bit. Yeah, I know
the
what you mean.
The toad has like an awesome, like, it looks like an animatronic, like, puppet made for 2 seconds. And then they cut to CG and it's super noticeable, which is disappointing. Yeah. But Pan is like all effects.
Pan and the Pale Man.
The Pale Man. Except for I noticed like the legs had a little CG done to
really?
The legs. Because the
I
legs are like bone thin.
Okay.
But that's it. And like he still looks super good. Like even with the eyes, which are clearly CG, like
yeah.
you My thoughts, and I'm not going to be like the hater on CG. Like, it's so easy to be like Michael Bay and Transformers, too much CG. Fuck that. Like, whatever. Like, it's a movie. Just shut up. Like, there's
enjoy
so much.
The
CG
ride.
Does good things, yeah. too, that yeah. you never know.
Exactly.
Like, you only notice bad CG. And, like, I'm pretty sure, like, what they did in Pan's Labyrinth, which is why I love it, is they do everything they can with makeup, only alter things with CG.
Tweak it.
Yes. So, like, Pan has, like, the backwards kneed legs. Obviously, CG had to be involved in that somehow. But you don't notice it because everything else is so real and in that moment. And Guillermo del Toro does this a lot. And I love it that he sticks, like, these big sets that he builds and, like, all these puppets and monsters and makeup effects. Those are the best.
I will say, it might not be CG on the backwards legs, and I will throw in, because
oh,
we're
do.
Talking about scary movies, when I was a child, you know, bringing this back to earlier when I said that the fucking Army of Darkness terrified me.
Yeah.
Another movie that used to scare the shit out of me was the movie Demon Knight, which was a...
Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt movie. But the demons in that movie...
Billy Zane is the devil.
Billy Zane, and that
Jada
movie,
Pinkett!
Yes, Jada Pinkett, and that movie made me fall in love with Billy Zane because he's so good.
Yeah.
But the demons in that movie have the backward legs, but they do it with like this
weird
stilt kind of thing that they implement. But it is achievable in practical makeup effects.
Yeah.
But coming, like, I remember like seeing Pan, especially like, I don't know, man, this character is so involved.
Yes.
Like, on the screen, like, he demands your, like, it's so weird looking, but also it's a testament to the character design that you don't know, is he a good guy, is he a bad guy? It's very ambiguous, and the makeup designs and Doug Jones' physical performance brings that through. Like, you do not know what to make of this character.
No, and you still really don't at the end.
Exactly.
And I like that.
Yeah. That's, again, you know, I love a movie where the bad guy wins or the good guy doesn't. And this is one of those types of movies.
I just like convention when it's thrown on its head.
Yeah.
It doesn't
yeah.
matter anything else. Just like shake up the formula a little bit. I'm good.
But like, you know, talking about that and the fact that he was also the Pale Man, which is one of those iconic figure, especially from this era of film.
Like, that's why you talk about Pan, and I'm like, I'm not head over heels with Pan. It's because it's in the movie with the Pale Man.
The Pale Man
and the
is so
Pale Man
weird.
Is like one of the best designs, or like one of the most like iconic, recognizable designs of the last 10 years.
Yeah, when he like picks up the eyes out of the bowl, and I'm miming here, people, when he puts them in front of his head and then opens his palms and you see the eyes.
Yeah.
And he like kind of hisses and like...
This, we need video to see what Kyle is
doing
right
God,
now.
Oh, my God, dude. That makes you so uncomfortable. And I think it's part of that is because of the uncanny valley. Like, you know, they always say that the most terrifying thing is something that's resembling human but is not human.
Yes. Yeah, that's the uncanny valley theory. And I agree with that. That's,
he's so on point. So what else you got here?
So real quick, I'll talk about the Pale Man. Commentary track bonus that I learned. Guillermo del Toro, before the movie came out, showed this to Stephen King.
Really?
And Stephen King sat there for the Pale Man sequence, the entire thing, and was squirming. And at the end, he looked over at Guillermo del Toro and he's like, "You have a masterpiece." And
that's
so
awesome.
Guillermo del Toro is like, "If I don't ever win an award, like, worth it. I have Stephen King's seal of approval for the
callback,
Pale Man."
As I said, caught as a wheel, Dark Tower. Reference that is the best Stephen King
and it's
Dark Tower ever. I'm a huge Stephen King fan, so that's awesome to know.
Yeah,
I could totally see that. Fucking fantastic.
Yeah, so I thought that was an interesting fact. But so this time, as I said before, like, I've seen this movie several times, so I went in this time really trying to dig deeper and notice more things. And like I said, this is just such a deep film. And I probably don't have all this right because I'm kind of guessing it myself. But the film, in the commentary track, Guillermo del Toro says it all boils down to choice and disobedience.
Yeah, I can
and
see that.
In the movie, Pan gives Ophelia three tests to pass. She fails two of them.
Mm-hmm.
She only passes the first test with the toad, which is, I think, really interesting. And let's just talk about the toad. So one of the clever things that Guillermo del Toro does, his film is just so dense with symbolism. So early on, you see Ophelia resting on her mom's pregnant belly. The mom is having issues with the boy, the new son, giving her a very rough pregnancy. She's having a hard time. Probably something bad's going to happen. Like, you just feel uneasy for this woman. And there's just this dread that this boy inside of her is bringing up.
Foreshadowing
is
what that's called.
Yes. Well, anyway, so Ophelia is resting her head on her mother's belly, and the scene goes down. Like, there's like a vertical wipe where like the black area comes and like a next scene comes in. And then you see like cave, almost tree-like roots and branches. And then it shows a shot of like the fetus having an issue, because Ophelia is talking to her brother and saying like, I'll make you a prince if you come out, just listen to me, do what I say, please don't hurt her.
Yeah.
And so you see the tree and the branches. So then she goes to this toad, and she has to get rid of this toad and find a key. The toad is inside this tree, feasting on everything around it, killing the tree.
Yeah.
This is the baby boy. Yeah. So not only did they foreshadow like the tree as they show the fetus, but now you see this toad that's killing its surroundings because it's needing all these nutrients and eating these bugs that Ophelia has to take, or has to kill to get a key. And so, like, I thought, I was like, that's really clever, like how they show these little things together. But the key and the knife are from the two fantasies. So she gets the key from the toad, and she gets the knife from the area with the pale man.
Yeah.
Both of these have a very significant part of reality. The key is what Mercedes has that she has copies of that she gives to the rebels
to get into the
yeah,
what it's where the supplies are, the supply closet.
Yeah, yeah, the supplies, yeah. And the food for the, and also if you want to look at that, like the toad could also be symbolism for the captain who is hoarding all the stuff and making the land around him and the people miserable and killing them off.
You mean symbolism can mean more than one
thing?
There's
so much fucking symbolism in this movie. It's so deep. Yeah. But she has the key. She disobeys. She makes a choice, which has a good effect on her in the end, which doesn't happen for everybody. But then, like, also the knife she gets is also Mercedes' knife that she has in her cloth.
Yeah, that she keeps rolling up.
El Capitan, which, again, they foreshadow.
Yeah.
And they also foreshadow the captain shaving with the blade so close to his face, like three or four times in the movie. And so when the scene finally comes where Mercedes, the put-upon maid, who's generally good, like we side with her, is kind of cornered and being interrogated by the captain, she puts in his mouth and cuts his face, which has been foreshadowed in the reality, in the fantasy. It's been foreshadowed several times. That is a smart fucking film when you can do that. And that is... it's these little details that made me fucking love this movie.
Well, and it makes me, you know, it makes me feel that I don't, if he was more, okay, let me restart this phrase and sentence. If Guillermo del Toro was an English-based director, he would not be as slept on as he is now, because he is one of the best fucking directors, I feel.
Yes.
He has such a grasp on foreshadowing, on symbolism, on nuance, on just good fucking movie making. Yeah. Like, if he spoke English as a native language, we would see so much more Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, I think so. I love Guillermo del Toro.
I do too, man. I fucking love this guy.
I'll be excited for him anytime he makes a movie. I'll be there. But he was part of three Spanish filmmakers who are some of the best. The time that he started coming to prominence was the time when Alejandro Iñárritu, who just did Birdman and I think Babel and other stuff, came about, and Alfonso Cuarón, who did Gravity and Children of Men. And these three Spanish filmmakers are just fucking lapping.
Dude, everybody.
American filmmakers.
Children of Men was like number 7 on my fucking list, man. That so made it close.
Children of Men is so good.
Oh my God, that movie is amazing. And
we will
talk about it.
The long takes in that film are mind-blowing.
Well, speaking of long takes, Birdman 2 is full of the long takes. I love the long take.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Though, and I'll I'll do 6 Degrees of Separation. So Guillermo del Toro directed directed Pacific Rim, which starred Charlie Day. Charlie Day was in Always Sunny. Always Sunny did an episode of called Charlie Work, which is showed everything Charlie has to do in a day. And it's Birdman. It is one take.
All long take.
It is like the drums, those manic drums
it's
from
great,
Birdman.
Man. It's great.
Yeah, so good.
We'll get into all this. I love this.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yes, coming back.
Masterful. What I really love most about him is just like the small details he pays attention to. And like, I feel like this man takes 10 hours to do one scene that most filmmakers would just send to their B-roll, just like 10 minutes and done and let's move on.
Very Kubrick-esque, you'd say?
Almost. Like Pacific Rim, I'm going to talk about that because I don't know any specific examples from Pan's Labyrinth, sadly. But Charlie Day's in there. Mm-hmm. He goes underground to hide from a kaiju that's coming. And the Asians around him kind of be like, they realize, he's after you. So they push him out of the way so like the kaiju will get him. He drops his glasses on the ground, and there's a shot of the glasses big in frame from the ground looking at him, trying to find him. Guillermo del Toro made a set of 6-foot-long glasses so they would look just right in this 1 second of film. And like that to me is like why like I love him, because it's like nobody would fucking do that.
I love Guillermo del Toro because at my heart, you know, again, we're in October. We're talking about the horror movies. I love a fucking good monster. And some of the best monsters I've ever seen in any movie ever are Guillermo del Toro movies. Holy shit.
Agreed.
This man does monsters so well. And
he
I
loves
them.
I think he loves his monsters and creatures more than the people.
I love it too. Dude, when I was in like sixth grade up through high school, every time I would doodle in a notebook, I was drawing weird monsters and dragons and weird shit. And I love them. And Guillermo gets that about me. And I think that's another reason I probably give him a little more credit than I should.
He deserves it all.
God damn, this man loves monsters. And I love him for that. So
he's a nerd. It makes me weep.
That's where we're at.
It makes me weep. Not only the Silent Hills cancellation that he was part
don't
of.
Talk about Silent Hills.
It's just
on,
super
bro.
Fucking sad.
Yes.
But like the Hobbit movies that came out.
Yeah,
he was going to direct them.
The original Hobbits.
The Peter Jackson. And there is fucking shit on the internet back when like he was in production and he was working on it of like the villain orcs like makeup costumes
that
look fantastic.
Yeah.
And we just get these CG very fakey.
So flat and unlifelike. And I don't get that because I love Peter Jackson. So what the fuck happened in those Hobbit movies, dude?
He lost it.
Like
he
the only good thing about the Hobbit movies is Smaug.
All right, so I'm not going to poo-poo on them too bad because I like the second and third one.
But you know what's
literally
great about
hated.
The second and third one is those two have fucking Smaug in them.
They do have Smaug in them.
Oh, my God.
They have Smaug in them. But it's spectacle now. Peter Jackson is just like spectacle. This is what can I do with computers?
Benedict Cumberbatch as Smaug. It's so good.
Very good. Benedict Cumberbatch's Doctor Strange is a thing that's going to happen.
I'm very
so
excited,
excited
about
for
that.
This.
So,
but
do you have? I guess we're kind of pushed a bit here. What do you have anything to wrap up on Pan?
Let me see. Let me look at my notes. So I talked about the sets and the special effects. So I already talked about the captain, but I think he's a little bit soap opery. He's Telemundo acting, and like everybody else is so grounded.
Yeah.
But like literally there's a shot where he does something. I think it's when he does the bottle in the head of the peasant who was hunting. And then afterwards they search through the bag and they find out, oh shit, he was telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, there's rabbits in here. And then like they do like a dramatic shot on his face where it's like, bah, bah, bah! And then like his face is just like the most fucking villainous face you can, and it's just like, that's from a soap opera. You're in Days of Our Lives, and everybody else is acting their shits out, and like, that guy, I'm disappointed with him. Alone.
I can agree with that, but at the same time, how many Spanish actors can you really pull from?
I have a quote.
Okay,
this
quote,
is something
quote
he
me.
Says. No, not you. I'm not quoting
no,
you.
No, I know, but quote to me.
Kyle said on October 2nd, Pan's Labyrinth is horseshit and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is so much better.
I would never say that.
He did not say that. I lied. All right. Quote from the movie. This guy says, they think we're equal. The war is over. We won. If I have to kill every one of these vermin, I will. And it's just like lines like this. There is no subtlety to this character. He is just like,
I am
Hitler too, and I have come to kill anybody who opposes me. And even people who are just fucking happenstance here. Hunting rabbits. Fucking kill them. Whatever. It's a little much.
He does have to come off as the dick. But I agree. Yeah. I mean, if it's, again, it's not a perfect movie. It's not my favorite movie. So therefore, it's not going
to
be my...
Well, like, no movie is perfect. This movie is really close to perfect. Like, that's just a small little thing.
That's why it's in my top five, bro.
It's this guy's acting was not enough to make me be like, I'm out of the movie. Like, it's fucking solid. And this is something I noticed 8 watchings into it. Like, this is now, like, the 8th time I've watched this movie. So, like, it's still really solid, really good. Like, I'd say near perfect. I don't think there are perfect movies.
Yeah, there cannot be.
It is so close.
I guess, so to wrap things up here with, like, you would not put Pan's Labyrinth in your top 5, but you would list it in your top 10.
Yes.
I would not list Kiss Bang Bang in my top 5 or probably my top 10, but
it's okay.
That does not make it a bad movie. I think it is a great movie. It is fun. It is fantastic. I love it. If I watch it again tomorrow, I will still enjoy it.
Yeah.
So,
like I said, I feel kind of bad because your movie is so deep, and then I give you like popcorn.
It's
popcorn. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is like the best fucking popcorn you'll ever have.
But it's film noir, but it's fucking popcorn. I love film noir. That's what I fucking love. Yeah. That's one of my favorite genres. So I appreciate it on that level for more than it's probably worth. Maybe. I don't know. But that fact alone gives it a big boost to me. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm definitely a big fan of it, too.
It's a good movie. It's fun. It is not bad. It's just probably not in my top 10. But that, again, that's not bad. And this is me. Who the fuck cares? Who am I? Who are you? Who cares? We're just talking about our favorite stuff.
Are we talking about The Matrix now?
No.
Who am I? Who are you?
You think that's air you're breathing now? I can quote it decades later. I still haven't seen it forever.
My favorite thing about that movie, or my favorite like one-off, we already talked about not like this. But I love the talk about chicken and what does chicken taste like, and then everything tastes like chicken because it's a glitch in the Matrix. And I'm like, brilliant, you have me. Yep. Like, I'm fully on board.
I get it now.
Yep.
So it was a bit long, but we're gonna wrap up episode 3 right there. Episode 3, first movies, number 5, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and Pan's Labyrinth. We both enjoyed them. Surprise.
Yes.
We pretty much agree they weren't much of a grind.
Not at all.
But they were good, enjoyable movies that we both recommend you should watch.
That's right.
Highly respectable in their own genres. Both are fantastic and fun. So
I disagree.
Check them out.
Please do.
Please do. And please continue to listen to us. And, you know, reach out to us. You can find us on the Facebooks. We're at The Experience Grind on Facebook. We have a Twitter. Surprise, it's at Experience Grind.
Yeah.
We also have an email, theexperiencegrind@gmail.com.
It's Gmail, it's not Hotmail. Yeah. So that's how you know it's legit.
I wish it was Hotmail, maybe if this was 1992. But, you know, reach out to us. We're going to have, you know, a lot of times here in the near future where we're going to ask you what you think and to ask us to talk about the things that you like as the listener.
Yes.
This is the experience. We want to experience things that you like. We might not like them, but we'll tell you honestly why not or why we do. So reach out to us. This is us. And, you know, stick around. Please enjoy us. We'll be here for a while. So for The Experience Grind again, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we thank you very much. So, you know, stick around next week. We'll be... the number 5 of our video games. My number 5 was Halo 1.
And my number 5 was Walking Dead Season 1.
Yeah, The Walking Dead Season 1, which we have both been grinding on.
And you say grind.
Yeah.
And you said this week we had no grinds because it was pretty easy for both of us.
Yeah. Video games are going to be a bit more of a grind because, you know, we do have to go through them. But again,
spoiler or tease for next time, I might have some issues with Halo.
That's fine.
I had to grind probably do too. Quite a bit.
I probably do too. I'm going to be honest. So stick around. Next week, we will be talking about Halo and The Walking Dead Season 1. So thank you a lot.